about a topic that's close to my heart today, and I thought that I would hold on 1 second. I need to get this figured out here on my screen. There we are. So I thought today's talk I'm going to cut into four parts. I would like to begin with a bit of a contextualization of the issue at hand so that we know how we got to where we are now. And then in a second part, I want to talk a little bit about the questionable practices of scholarly publishers. Begin small. Before I then get to part three, which will be about the current situation, the current discussions that are being had right now, and I will close with a little bit of an epilogue. It's not going to be long, but to just point out to from our perspective in the Open Science team, where we see that researchers, i.e. you, find yourselves in this situation, and just to very briefly sketch out some strategies, resources, and alternatives that are available to you at the university. So I will go ahead with a little bit of background, a little bit of once upon a time, so that we have a bit of a context in which to couch the discussion. At the end of the 20th century, there were a couple of developments that came together and gave rise to one of the biggest shifts in scholarly communications ever, really. And those two developments were, on the one hand, the so-called serials crisis, where libraries, academic libraries around the planet, were no longer able to afford to subscribe to the scholarly literature because the prices had gone through the roof, and the budgets had not. So the budgets remained the same, and there was a real tension, which led to significant problems with supplying researchers with the necessary literature. And the other thing that happened was, of course, the advent of the digital age and the internet in particular. So what happened at around the millennium is that several interest groups and representatives of the landscape, the scholarly communication landscape, from all sorts of institutions and aspects of that landscape came together and formulated a vision, a very bold vision, which was then put together in the so-called Budapest Open Access Initiative. I'll link that on the at the bottom. And Fabian, you will be able to. I will send you the file, sir, the slides, so folks can click about to their heart's content when we're done here. So the idea, the vision was, you see that on the right, was to combine, to seize the historical moment and to combine the old and the new. The old tradition, as is put forth here, is the willingness of researchers and the tradition of researchers to share their work for free, because most don't get paid for publishing, with their colleagues and with anyone who is of an inquiring mind. And the new is, of course, the new technology of the internet. And combined, they thought they will get to what they coined to be open access, right? It's the digital publication age, and open access, wouldn't it be great if we could make that the goal in this new era, that as long as you have internet access, you can access scholarly information and work for free. And then it goes on with what you can do with this sort of thing. You can see that here, how you can reuse it, that scholarly information. And the only constraint, and that's quite interesting down here in terms of copyright, is that authors will retain the rights to their work. And this is quite important. And this was one of the key ideas, the cornerstones, stones of this new vision of a better scholarly communication landscape. Now, this is 20 years ago, and this is a lovely vision. And in the wake of this vision, we saw the development of a plethora of initiatives and organizations that that worked and still work towards making this a reality. You have that on a variety of levels. You have that, for example, on national levels. Switzerland has a national open access strategy. Was one of the first countries to have one, which came into effect in 2017 and lasts until next year. And we're currently working on extending that and do a follow-up strategy. You have initiatives like the Directory of Open Access Journals, who are trying to create a whitelist of journals that do open access right. And I'm going to refer to that doing science right, doing open access right throughout this talk. But what the folks in Budapest with a vision, of course, couldn't foresee at that point, that early point, is how that would pan out in practice. It's one thing to have this vision. It's another thing to make it happen. And I want to highlight two of the pathways that have developed over the 20 odd years since. And that is one's Open Access Green, which is self-archiving. In my opinion, a really, really possibly disruptive way of making open access a reality, because it basically just means that you self-archive the work on a repository, like in our instance in Bern at Boris, and you make it available there in open access. This is interesting. I'm not going to go into that too much. I'm going to refer back to it in at a later point. But the interesting and that it's still disruptive can be seen that, for example, last year, about a year ago, the SNSF signed Plan S and recommended its researchers that if they want to go the green route and make and fulfill the obligations of the SNSF in terms of open access publishing, they should put a passage into their manuscript when they submit that to the publisher that says that they retain the rights to their manuscript. And that goes back to the Budapest initiative that we saw just before. Just to point out, this work is mine, and as long as you, i.e. publisher, have not altered it significantly, it will remain mine. And the idea behind that is that you can make your author-accepted manuscript available in open access immediately upon publication and get around what publishers have insisted on so far, which is the embargo period, so that you have to wait. The other version of open access that has gained prominence, or that we are basically in the middle of experiencing, is the open access gold route, that is publishing in an open access journal or as open access books, immediately accessible with an open license, but for money. And it makes sense, right? Publishers are businesses, and for the most part, or for a large part, and they have to continue making money to be in existence. And so if the access to the scholarly literature is free, the only other party in that transaction that can pay is, of course, the author. And so what we had was the ascent of the author pays model over the last 20 years. Now, the legacy publishers had to think quick. They were very, very reluctant to embark on that journey for obvious reasons. But in the meantime, where we are now, we see that there is this new model, the author pays model, that has taken a very strong foothold in the market. And that means that legacy publishers, particularly with established journals, conclude deals with universities, sometimes with consortia of university libraries, sometimes even on a national level, to provide not only access to the literature, but also the possibility for researchers who are at the institutions that are making those deals to publish in those titles in open access. Now, never, please, never think that this is for free because someone is paying. It's not you. It's not the institute for which you work within the university, but it is the university libraries that are paying a heck of a lot of money for this kind of deal to be in place. Another thing that happened over the course of the last 20 years since this all started is that you had the rise of new open access digital first publishing venues. They were from the very beginning thought to be an alternative, a viable alternative to the legacy publishers who basically were who were trying to shift the existing model of selling or providing university libraries and researchers with information to this new environment. And these new publishing venues, they started digital first, right? They didn't have to worry about the tail of existing print journals, subscription journals. They said, now we're going to go open access first. You bring us money as authors, right? Author pays model, and we will publish everything in open access the way that this is intended to be, and is there's a growing demand for it, for example, from funders. And the examples for that, you see some illustrious names mentioned here: Biomed Central, the Public Library of Science, PeerJay eLife and Medicine, and last but by no means least, the two open access gold publishing venues here in Switzerland, Frontiers in Lausanne and in the MDPI in Basel. Where there is a new lucrative business model and way of making a living, there are cowboys and what we saw for as well, pretty much from the very beginning, is the rise of predatory publishing. And I say publishing and not publishers for a reason. And placing that little triangle here is also not coincidental. Practices have arisen that have become rather concerning, and I want to use the next part to talk a little bit about that. Now, predatory publishing is a difficult term, and there have been many attempts to define it, early attempts by folks like Geoffrey Beall with his famous Beall's List, a blacklist of questionable journals that he himself curated with his own idea of what is good and what is bad, which then got eventually overtaken by more nuanced and more comprehensive definitions. On the left-hand side, you see something from a book that came out recently that isn't really helpful because it is very vague. On the right side, on the right-hand side, you see a consensus definition that a variety of initiatives and organizations work with, for example, all European academies, uses this particular definition to describe what predatory journals and predatory publishers really are about, right? And you can see there's more meat on this, and you can look at it and say, okay, I can work with this. I know that if I see, I don't know, a publisher who is lacking transparency and or sends me misleading information about the way they're doing business and or spams me with a plethora of aggressive and indiscriminate emails, then I know that's probably not a good home for my research. So this is more helpful. Does it hold water? I don't think so, not anymore, because things have become very complex and they have become very, there's a lot of gray area now. It is not easy to say yes, Omics is a predatory publisher, and clearly, I don't know, Springer is not. Or you can play that through many of the of the companies providing these kind of services. So it is really an attempt to find a simple definition and understanding of a rather complex situation. And that becomes obvious when you look at some of the fallacies and paradoxes that have evolved around this notion of questionable practices and particularly predatory publishing. In the beginning, there was this notion, and I think that's where the expression came from in the first place, that predatory, right, that presupposes that you, as the researchers who might fall into this trap, are helpless prey. Right, as a predator, aren't there? As a prey, that you are the unsuspecting antelope that is being attacked, if you wish. But that's not the case. If you start looking more closely at who is publishing so-called predatory or questionable outlets, these are people who have a variety of motivations to do so. Some will fall into traps, and that's beyond dispute. But others make the decisions. There are researchers who just don't care where they publish. There are researchers who have no choice but to publish in cheaper, fast turnaround venues because in their countries they're under a certain amount of pressure and so on. And it's also a fallacy to believe that all research published in a predatory outlet is bad. That's by no means a given. You know, that's far from the truth. By the same token, it is wrong to believe that if a traditional, perhaps even prestigious, publisher has a new business idea and tries to bring that over to its potential authors, that it is by default an acceptable practice. That's not so. And let me give you an example. I mentioned it here. The American Chemical Society recently reacted to the rights retention strategy that I mentioned before, where you as researchers can immediately upon publication make the author accepted manuscript available in a repository. And they said, fine, that's okay, you can do that. We will still publish your stuff in closed access. But if you go that way and you do not wait an embargo period of, I think they have 12 months, you need to bring us an extra $2,500 for us to give you the kind of contract where you are allowed to do this. And I'm sorry, but that is not kosher, because that's not how this is supposed to work. There's a big controversy. There's a lot of backlash against this move, and I linked it here in case you're interested. But just to show you that there are attempts and ways that publishers are trying to find new revenue streams to control and harness this fiscally, financially control and harness this development of open access publishing. There's a paradox that was developed in the book that just slipped by on the last slide. This is a very recent book, and I found it interesting because it is worth to consider this. Publishers are businesses, established publishers who are serious about their business. For them, what open access has meant is that the clients for their business is no longer the library or the reader. The client now is the author, right? And with that shift, there is a new focus on how to make the service of publishing and the transaction more palatable and interesting to the new client. Now, one of the things that that authors, scholarly authors, academic authors have often bemoaned is the fact that it takes so long to get something published. Peer review can take, I don't know, half a year. Editing and layout and all these sorts of things, it can take too long. So one of the things naturally that a business will do if it's serious about its clients is it's going to try and work and create a client experience, if you wish, that makes it more interesting for their client to return or to come to them in the first place. So one of the things that publishers, for example, MDPI, who I'm going to be talking about in a little while, have done is to invest in new workways to make sure that the turnarounds are faster. And the efficiency that this creates, and this is the paradox, should be welcome, but it isn't. It isn't because there is suspicion and the notion that it can't be done that fast and be done well. And the problem that we have and that you specifically as researchers have is to be able to tell the difference. And that's what I mean when I say that things have become rather confusing and there's a big gray area. The damage that we have witnessed over the same amount of time of questionable practicing, including predatory publishing, is compounded. It used to be that the notion of loss, right? You publish in a bogus journal, you as a researcher lose out on something that you can show for your work, right? But also it's the research that has been invested in, that has been financed, that has been conducted, that took time and a lot of effort is lost in these journals. It cannot be found, right? Because some of these early, particularly early cowboy journals, they just shut down and they were not, you know, hooked into any kind of metadata infrastructure. So it was gone. And of course, in the bigger picture, we're going to get back to bigger pictures in a minute. There's this notion, there's a loss of trust in research and science. And that's the last thing that we need, not in the crazy times that we live in. Now, these earlier concerns are now compounded by two more concerns, and these concerns are not only the loss, and that is now developing because folks are becoming more sophisticated with their scams, but also with reputable publishers, there is the fear of sustainability, and I don't just mean money. Of course, that is the one that I listed first, right? There are steady price hikes of author processing fees, both in books and in journal literature, but also there is a phenomenal increase of output, and that begs the question of how sustainable that is in terms of work. Stuff needs to be read, it needs to be written, it needs to be edited, it needs to be peer reviewed. That is work that it has to be done somewhere. And if you increase your output, who can really do this work, and for how much longer and how much more? Here's an article I just referenced, that a study from 2021 over a 10-year period on the rise of per article average APC in fully open access journals, showing that it is going up a lot. So if you're interested in those numbers, you can look at that. And here is a graph, I think, that speaks for itself in terms of the increase of content over the last 10 or so years. You know, I mean, we are now at 1.6 million articles in 2022. 1 year, 1.6 million articles, and that's more than twice as many as 9 years earlier. Now you project that forward to another 10 years, and the question is, something's got to give, right? At some point, it's not going to be possible to sustain that kind of growth. Speaking of growth, you can see here, for example, MDPI is one of the publishing houses that has managed to put out staggering amounts of input, but we'll get back to that in a second. So where are we now? Part three, where are we now? I've mentioned various interest groups with individuals, researchers like you, publishers who have their business interests to look out for, funders and institutions who have a different idea on how scholarly communication should work again, and of course governments. I haven't linked it here, but there is, for example, a UNESCO Declaration of Open Science, and you know, a lot of nations are part of that and have to also report to the UNESCO board on a yearly basis, I even think, on the progress that they're making for open science. And that includes, of course, open access. Now, the issue is that even after 20 years, we're nowhere near the finishing line. You know, we are in the middle of this development and there are conflicting goals. Your goals might be very difficult to get under one hat with the goals of, I don't know, your funder. But there's friction that arises from that. But as I said, if you look at the growth that is connected to open access digital publishing at the moment is not sustainable in the long run. So as Pablo Gomez Barrero said here, folks need to have an uncomfortable conversation where we're going to go with this, with scientific publications, because one thing that we do not want, and I mentioned that when I talked about the concern of loss and the damage of loss, is that we may lose scientific rigor, and that's surely not in the interest of anyone. So let me quickly get to MDPI as an example, not the example. I can tell you loads of stories about any other given big publisher, I'd be happy to, but we pick this out because MDPI has been in the press and has been at the focus of some robust conversations pertaining to this sustainability issue for the last months. This is an article that I referenced, and I think it puts out quite clearly what we're looking up in terms of volume. Two of MDPI's flagship journals will this year alone, just in this year, publish more than 7,000 special issues. That's two journals. They have a lot of journals at MDPI. So those two together will put out more than 7,000 journals, and that's more than about 18 a day. And the question that rises from that is, well, not just, you know, how effective can that really be in terms of quality control and the like, but also about the relevance. I mean, do we need to have all this stuff floating about, and is it really relevant to what it is that science is doing, and not just science, but all academic, you know, endeavors? Do we really need that kind of inflationary accumulation of work? And here you see another graph where you see just how successful MDPI was with the increase of its special issues, right? There used to be only 15% of its entire output, and now it's 85%. That's a huge shift. And what is interesting is that you can see that some of the big legacy publishers further down here are starting to have the same idea. Because of course, I mean, it's a competition, right? And it is a very lucrative business model. For a while, there has been a lot of criticism voiced very publicly, and MDPI has gotten the brunt of that criticism. Here's a post that I found on Mastodon at the end of October, referencing a blog post that I also linked to on the bottom here, and this person said, okay, I've had enough of the bashing because a lot of the big, particularly STM publishers, are doing the exact same thing. Look at Nature, right? Everyone wants to publish in a Nature thing. That's a title. But they're not doing things that are that different, right? Because their name is so loaded with prestige that they can get away with this as well. And sure enough, it is perhaps not entirely fair to attack MDPI to such an extent, because as Miller shows, They get some things right, transparency being one of them. You're going to be hard pushed to find a lot of transparent information on pricing, on revenue, and the like from Springer Nature. You can find it on the NDPI site. But the problem that I have with all of this is that it doesn't really tackle the underlying problem. This is a bit of whataboutism that we witness here with this kind of argumentation. The deeper issue is that we need to get away from the business as usual in order to be able to sustain a meaningful academic scholarly conversation and exchange of information that doesn't, where we don't lose track of the quality and the rigor associated, and that is the backbone of scientific results. If you wish, there is this one approach on the right-hand side is referenced. It's called the Open Commons, where we have a might be a bit too radical for some folks, but the idea that is and that is in important here is that scholars could be ought to be the stewards of public knowledge, and not the business models that are driving the current developments. Let me get to my epilogue real quick. Where does all of this lofty talk and all these examples, where does that leave you in concrete terms? Well, it leaves you with some tough decisions. You can't you have your own pressures, and I am aware of those to perform, to compete in the rarefied air of academe. It's not a cozy business, right? So you might be saying, okay, APC publishing gives me fast publication. I might have possible access to funding with Read and Publish or an academic publishing fund like we have at the University of Bern, if you have, for example, book publication that you want to do open access. You have an uncomplicated submission and review process, and yeah, that is very good argumentation towards going that route. At the same time, you need to, of course, be careful about the things and the cons, the potential cons on the right-hand side: reputation, affordability, equity. We're moving towards an ethical argumentation. But whatever your decision is, I often say that, and you'll forgive me if that is obvious, but it's so important to be informed about the rules of the game before you submit your manuscript. Once you submit your manuscript, it's often very difficult to reverse your decision or to walk a different path. Some pointers, particularly for journals, on the left-hand side, some questions you can ask yourself. On the right-hand side, I collected some links to tools that you might find helpful in the selection process for your next publication. But first and foremost, what is really important to me, and that's to come back to the beginning, I'm so thrilled that I had the chance to talk here today, is please know that we have a dedicated team of open science specialists at the library, and we are here to help. That's our job. So if you have any kind of questions pertaining to open access publishing, please make sure that you get in touch with us. And now I'll stop. Thank you.